This is the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. I'm your host, Jess Root from CardsWire.com, the NFL wire site, covering the Arizona Cardinals from the USA Today family of sites. My co-host is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, SB Nation's Arizona Cardinals site. And this is episode 267 as we have hit the lull of the offseason, but we do have some stuff to talk about because the schedule was released last week. And so we now have something to talk about as the Cardinals are in the middle of OTAs, though we don't know much about them because they're not on the field. They're all via Zoom. There's been some media availability, Cliff Kingsbury, so the draft picks, Chandler Jones. But other than that, there's not much going on with the Cardinals, Seth. How does it feel to have, well, first of all, the schedule is out. How confident are you that this is actually good, like the schedule's going to be played out as scheduled?
I mean, play out the schedule, maybe not super confident. But I do think what the NFL did was, you know, astute. I think they predicted that there could still be some issues. I mean, this is May 12th and there's rumblings or reports out of California that they're going to lock down for the next 3 months. We've seen New York is still kind of struggling there. And, you know, that's obviously more important than football. And so the way the NFL set it up is every team plays two home and two away games, their first four games. Well, guess what? You either just cut those four games or you move them to the back end of the schedule. I don't know how that would work because I don't know how you could move the Super Bowl itself. But, you know, it was smart to plan it that way because now you have, you know, 12 games with six home and six away for every team. And, you know, maybe that, you know, you figure out a bye week situation or you just keep the bye weeks and now people have really early or really late bye weeks. I don't know. But I think it's probably 75% that we see the schedule, all 16 games play out as planned. And then 25% that maybe, you know, maybe we don't get all 16 games or they have to maneuver the order in some way to make it all work. But, you know, I would say 75% that it plays out the way it is right now.
That's kind of my feeling as well. I know Peter King wrote about it and talked about, now, at least risk it first, the Super Bowl, that's actually fairly easy from what I understand, is that Raymond James Stadium in Tampa Bay could be played any one of those Sundays in February. And I believe they scheduled it, and I know it works for the Cardinals, actually, and it's actually important that the Cardinals opened on the road because if for some reason they decided to take those first four games in the schedule and then just put them, instead of weeks one through four, they become like 18, 19, 20, 21, and they just wipe out weeks one through four. If you just took those 4 weeks and put that on the back end, it works for the Cardinals because State Farm Stadium, I don't know if listeners, you know this, there's a reason why the Cardinals finish on the road every single year. And that's because of the Fiesta Bowl. And so they have an agreement in place is that the Fiesta Bowl needs X amount of time. And so that last week, week 17, they never play in State Farm Stadium because of the Fiesta Bowl. And naturally, because they got to get the stadium ready. And by playing, if week one had to be played on January 10th, that would still allow the Fiesta Bowl to happen uninterrupted, and the Cardinals would just play in Santa Clara instead. And then after the Fiesta Bowl's come and gone, they would be back on January 17th, no problem, and they've already had the recovery. So I know that at least it was said, I think Peter King wrote about it, is that they built the schedule so that they could take the first 4 weeks or the first 8 weeks and just put them on the back end of the schedule, at least the first 4 weeks, and it wouldn't cause any problems. And I know that actually works for the Cardinals. So on one hand, you know, Cardinals fans, we're going to talk about the schedule in this edition of the show. While you'd love to start at home, starting on the road was actually a critical component to building in some coronavirus safety measures or contingencies for the schedule. I hope for the sake of normalcy. I know there's things bigger than football. Here locally, I think we're very lucky in Arizona where by September, we're probably at least statewide going to be in an okay place to do things. I know the governor just opened up the state for pro sports, at least for now, with no fans. And if we have to start the season with no fans at the stadium, at least that's something. Obviously, it would be better if fans can go, at least in a limited capacity. But it would, like, getting football normal will feel really good for everyone. And if we're able to do that safely, it's not too historic, but it would be a major landmark and a major turning point for our nation if we're able to safely have football again and have safety and not have the season affected really in any way. It'd be fantastic. Now, in this edition of the show, episode 267, we are focusing on the Cardinals schedule. So what we will kick off the schedule, we're going to run down the schedule. We're going to go through what we like. Then we're going to talk about what we don't like about the schedule. We're going to go with, it's super early, I know it's May. We're going to go with win-loss predictions. We're going to go game by game what we think as of May, you know, months away, what the Cardinals' chances are of winning those games. What are the toughest games on the schedule? Which one of the must wins? There's been some minor roster moves. And with OTAs, there's some comments we want to talk about. Isaiah Simmons is one of the concerns that we had, at least Seth especially, about the use of Isaiah Simmons. Let's kind of break down some of the comments that Cliff Kingsbury said. And to end the show, we will wrap up talking about some of those early futures bets that there are for some awards, which includes Kyler Murray, Cliff Kingsbury, Isaiah Simmons, and Chandler Jones. So kicking off this show, let us talk about the schedule. Let's run it down for you. So we start off with the schedule. They will have a week 8 bye. And this is kind of schedule as we go. We're just going to go kind of through the schedule, start week 1. Week 1, they are on the road to play the San Francisco 49ers, the NFC champs, to kick off the season on the road. They play their next two games at home. They will take on the Washington Redskins in week 2 for a 1 o'clock game. Then they will host the Detroit Lions, a 1:30, a 1:25 start. In week 4, they will be on the road for the first of 3 straight road games. They'll be on the road in Carolina to play the Panthers in week 4, 10 a.m. slot. The following week, October 11th, in week 5, they will be in the 10 o'clock slot playing the New York Jets on the road. And then they will end that 3-game road swing with a Monday night football game in week 6 against the Dallas Cowboys at AT&T Stadium. That they'll be there. Then they will close out they'll return home for one game. They'll take on the Seattle Seahawks in the 1 o'clock time slot and then have their bye. Coming off the bye, they will end up having 3 home games in a row, even though it's a home game bye, home. They will take on the Miami Dolphins at home in week 9, 2:25 start, followed by the Buffalo Bills at 2:05 the next week in week 10. After that, they hit the road for their second game against the Seahawks. They will be on primetime for the second time. Thursday night football game in Seattle against the Seahawks in week 12. in week 11. They have their mini bye. And then in week 12, at the end of November, they will hit the road to play the New England Patriots, an 11 a.m. start. So they will get to take on the Patriots on extra rest, but on the road. Week 13, they come back home, 2 p.m. start. They take on the L.A. Rams for the first time. So they don't see the Rams until December. Then they go on the road in week 14 to take on the New York Giants. They will return home in week 15 for two games. Week 15, they take on the Philadelphia Eagles. And then they will take on the San Francisco 49ers at home. And they will close the season January 3rd, 2:25 p.m. On the road against the L.A. Rams. Kind of an interesting thing to do. They will face San Francisco in week 1 and week 16. Lots of spread. They'll face the Seahawks twice in not too many weeks, in week 7 and week 11. And then they're going to face the Rams twice in their final five games as they play them in December and in January. So that is the rundown of the schedule. Seth, what do you like most? What are the things that you like about the schedule?
I like the early season schedule. So the first seven games leading up into the bye, I like that a lot. That gives the Cardinals a real opportunity, one, to get out of the gate fast. I think Washington, Detroit, Carolina, New York are all games that the Arizona Cardinals should have a very good chance at winning. I think both the 49ers and Cowboys games should be toss-up, leaning obviously towards the home team, both 49ers and Cowboys. And then the Seahawks should, give us kind of a really nice understanding of where the Cardinals are in the hierarchy of the NFL. If they somehow, can go into that Seahawks game 4-2 or, 5-1. I mean, heaven forbid 6-0, but 4-2, and the two losses are to the two playoff teams, the 49ers and Cowboys, you feel okay. You feel like they're on the right track, and they're maybe not a division winning type of team yet, but they're a team that's competing. And then that Seattle game will show truly, where they are kind of in that competing manner. That is, I think, going to tell us a good tale. I think it's also good because it gives them a chance to show out on prime time early. Maybe they come into that game at 4-1, and that game is a 4-1 Cardinals team against, a 4-1 or 5-0 Cowboys team. And I don't even know the Cowboys schedule outside of that they get to beat the Rams in LA to start the season. But, the Cowboys are going to have the chance, or the Cardinals are going to have the chance to, kind of show that they are not the Cleveland Browns of 2009. Remember, that was the big thing. And I think maybe more than anything else hurt the Cardinals coming into this year was that the Browns were kind of the darlings coming into the season. They played in three primetime games in the first five games. So it was, let's get the Browns, they're the hot ticket, on TV as much as possible. And I think other teams the NFL looked at that and goes, okay, well, we don't want to go that far again. We don't want to buy in that much. We don't want to give them, three or four games, especially early in the season, where maybe they're not a good team. And so I think that week 6 Monday Night Football game, that gives the Cardinals a good chance to be at, like I said, hopefully 4-1 going into that game. And then they come out of that and they get to really measure up. If they were to lose that game, they get to really measure up to where they are, especially in the NFC West, going against, the rival Seahawks at home that week.
Me, I there's a few things I like about it. Now, I did write leading up to the schedule release, I pounded the table for a Cowboys Cardinals Thanksgiving game. I thought it would have been a perfect game, a perfect matchup for that. But the NFL did have that idea in mind. You got Cliff Kingsbury and Kyler Murray, both Texas people. Kyler Murray has a lot of fans in Texas. He's from Texas in high school. Cliff Kingsbury, incredibly popular, still out there. You've got an up-and-coming team against and two teams that offensively should put up a lot of points. I thought Thanksgiving would be perfect. Got the next best thing. If they were always going to have to go on the road to play the Cowboys, why not do it in prime time? So you get a Monday night matchup. I love it. I love that game. I know it's not going to be easy playing in Jerry World and national TV is not going to be. It's going to be the big stage for a lot of these young players, but I think this is the type of game that the Cardinals need to build on. I like that they start playing the two of their first three games at home. And this end of season, they play two of their last three games at home. So now while they finish and end on the road, they have a good spot there in September, and they have a good spot there at the end of the season. And granted, they're going to be playing teams in December that are going to be tougher. And I do like you said, I do like the potential soft start of the schedule. Now, granted, San Francisco 49ers, as Cliff Kingsbury said yesterday on Monday, that'll get your attention. You're opening the season on the road against the NFC champs, a team that really dominated everyone except the Cardinals. The Cardinals gave them really kind of everything that they could handle, and so everyone opens. They're both healthy. They're both rested. They're both have all this extra time to scheme and plan for week one. So that'll get your attention. But yeah, after that, the next four games should be very winnable games when you're thinking about, hey, and if you look at it, you have Washington, Detroit, and Carolina. Three of those, the next three games, are teams that drafted ahead of you, and the Jets, which weren't far behind you. And so those are all teams that you would hope, if the Cardinals are what we want them to be, they're winnable games. I like that they balanced the three-game road trip with a three-game homestand, and I like that they get the mini bye before New England. So those are all things that I liked about the schedule. Coming up next on the Rise of Secret podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. We'll move on. Let's talk about what we don't like about the schedule, because this isn't an easy schedule. So that's coming next on Rise of Secret. We're back on the Rise of Secret podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's talk about what we don't love about the schedule. And Seth, what don't you like about this schedule?
You hit on it. I hate that three-game road swing, Carolina, New York, Dallas, partially because it's kind of all over the place. Carolina is, more south southeast, and then you've got New York, obviously northeast, and then they got to go to Dallas, Texas, which is, south. And it's just – over 15 days to have to make all those flights, you would like the opportunity to break that up in some way. Like you said, they have a three-game homestand, so to speak, but they have that bye week in between. So they're at home for almost a month, but they play, Sunday, October 25th, and then they don't come back until November 8th. So really it's a little bit different than having to, travel. Now they'll be home the entire 4 weeks, but it's not as easy, and not that it's ever easy, but it's not as easy. I really hate having to play Buffalo and then going up to Seattle. Even though that Buffalo game's at home, they're going to be one of the most physical defenses in the entire NFL. And then they have to go up to to Seattle to try to, you know, duke it out with one of, you know, the better or more consistent teams in the NFC. That's going to be really tough. And then, you know, you look at that December schedule, and it's going to be really – it's going to be rough. While three of the games are at home, they've struggled mightily since Sean McVay took over the L.A. Rams. Then they have to go to New York in December. Those are going to be awful conditions. And then they get two teams that are probably going to be playing for either seeding or just to be in the playoffs in the NFC with the Eagles and the 49ers. So that December schedule is just – it's just really – it's a brutal four-game stretch in December that, you know, while we talk about those first seven games and hopefully going into the bye, you know, 5-2, at worst 4-3 – four-game run in December could really break a team that maybe, you know, maybe going into those last five games, you know, so coming out of that New England game, they're sitting, you know, at a 6-5 record, and they need to find a way to go 3-2 or, you know, even better down the stretch. And that four-game could be just a miserable time for that team.
It really can, especially if the Cardinals aren't quite as good as we want them to be. That can be really a letdown it sets itself up for, especially to those last three games. Remember that Pittsburgh game. Philly fans and San Francisco fans, they will travel. So if they start to sputter, those are games that could end up being full of opposing fans. That said, if the team is competitive, I actually like a tough December schedule, because if they end up making the playoffs, then they're really kind of playoff tested. Philly should be in the mix. San Francisco should be a playoff team. The Rams should be in the mix. We don't know I don't know exactly if New England leading into that's going to be in the mix or not. They're kind of a wild card in all of this. The one major complaint I have about this schedule is just, they have to play the Seahawks twice on short weeks. As if the Cardinals don't have enough issues playing the Seahawks, especially at home, but they have to play them twice on short weeks because their first game is... It's after a three-game road swing, and it's a week before the bye, so they're going to be a worn-out team and just have played on Monday night. So they'll have 24 hours to 36 fewer hours of recovery leading up to the Seattle game at home, kind of the midpoint of the season. And so while there might be kind of re-energized being back at home, they'll be staring at that bye week. That's, depending on the type of the team they have, that could go sideways in a hurry. And then they have to play in Seattle on Thursday night. That's never a fun thing. So if the everything about the schedule, the one thing that I like the least, it would be the fact that they have to face the same team twice on a short week. It's going to be a tough enough division anyway, by what we imagine. But to have to face the Seahawks, who are, like you said, incredibly consistent, twice on short weeks, it seems the one part that's unfair. I know the three-game road swing isn't fun, but in fairness, the Cardinals requested to have two East Coast games in a row because they plan on staying back east. They're probably going to stay at the Greenbrier again. And I'll be honest, what I wished they had done is what the 49ers get to do in weeks 2 and 3, or 3 and 4, whatever it is, and they get to play the Jets and the Giants on the road in consecutive weeks. So they get to play in the same stadium 2 weeks in a row. They can just stay back there and do whatever. Maybe staying in New York. Who knows what's going to happen with that. But the Cardinals asked for that, and so I get why they did it. But so the three-game road trip isn't fun. I don't have a major complaint about that. I don't have a complaint about starting on the road against San Francisco. I think that's a really good since the Cardinals don't have major expectations, there's really nothing to lose from that game other than, unless they get shellacked. It's different than that 2016 opener against the Patriots, where there was coming into that season with so many expectations, then to lose in the fashion that they did, where they should have won the game, it really mentally took them out of it. And the fact they did against Jimmy Garoppolo, we talked about on this show years ago, there was a no-win situation for the Cardinals, because heading into that season with all those expectations, if they beat Jimmy Garoppolo and the Patriots, you're like, oh, well, I got the win. Yeah, good for you. It was Jimmy Garoppolo. They lose like they did, and they're like, oh, you're not good. And they ended up not being good. So those are my own call. I don't have a problem with the San Francisco game. I just wish they didn't have to play the Seahawks twice on short weeks. I think that's dumb. Playing the Rams both late in the season, I don't love that, because your face, it could be a benefit depending on how this Rams season goes. But the division schedule balanced better.
And well, the fact that they've struggled with them too, that makes it, because it doesn't seem like we've gotten a Rams game before week 8 in a while, has it? I mean, I can't remember the last time they played the Rams. It seems like every year they're playing the Rams like that. Like it's since, I think it was the last time. Oh, I guess last year they did, or 2 years ago. I forgot about, I blacked out that entire season. That doesn't count. Steve Wilkes' season doesn't count, because that was the 34-0 game. Nobody remembers that game.
we're just blacking out that year completely.
I mean, you could have paid me, and I would not have remembered that they played in the second week of the season against the Rams, because I really did black out that game specifically for that reason.
Yep, that was no good. Yeah, they've got to beat Sean McVay finally. That would be.
I know.
It's getting
ridiculous.
All right, cut up next on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. We're going to move on to win-loss projection. We're going to talk about the tough games, which are the must wins. We're going to go through our predictions for the season. Super early, ridiculous early predictions. That's coming up next on Rise of C-Red. We're back on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's get into our predictions. It wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do, but it was an assignment that I was asked to do for the network, and that would be game-by-game predictions. Did you do a game-by-game prediction as well, or did someone else on your site did that?
Yeah, I did.
So, let's break this down. I will say I predicted a 9-7 season. I know it's optimistic, and in fact, it's super common. I will say this. When you have team sites like the type of thing we do, I compiled all of my network's writers and what they predicted for their teams. It was laughable how optimistic their team predictions were. The worst prediction were, I think there came out to a total of 10 out of the 32 writers predicted a losing season for their teams that they cover. The Giants and the Redskins writers predicted 5-11. I think the Panthers predicted 6-10. But yeah, then even the Bengals writer predicted 8-8. I don't do this to mock them, but because it's really hard for a team that you cover, especially in our situations, like fans, analysts, the fanalist type of thing, if you want to call it that, it's hard to separate reality with expectations and hopes, especially this early in the year. So I will say mine are optimistic, but I don't think I did anything crazy. So I broke down my season like this, and I went game by game. 9-7, and we'll go game by game in a second. I went like this. Okay. I'm going to say they split the division games, winning their home games, losing on the road. I mean, it's not gone like that the last few, but it's like, if the Cardinals are an okay team, that's something you can expect. I did not expect them to beat any team that would be like, hey, like any real upset. Okay? And when I came to that the end of the schedule, it was 9-7. Let's start in week one. Seth, do you expect the Cardinals to knock the NFL world on their side and surprise everyone with a win in their season opener?
No, I have them losing another close one to San Francisco. I think they are getting close, but they're not quite there yet.
24-17, 49ers is the way I go. The Cardinals offense is San Francisco defense holds the 49. They hold the Cardinals offense down, but they don't score too many points. 24-17, lose by a touchdown. Hey, they still cover the spread because the early spread right now is 8.5. Even as of right now, I'm hitting the Cardinals. I'm taking the Cardinals plus 8.5 all day right now. They covered both games last year, and I think that's going to be a fun game. Week two. Against the Redskins. So you have them starting 0-1. I have them going 0-1. How do you see them taking on the Redskins in week two?
I've got them blowing out the Redskins 35-20. Big win. Kind of getting the offense on track after a week one loss.
Same here. 31-17 is the prediction I make. They're 1-1. Your Cardinals are 1-1. They head into week three taking on the Detroit Lions, and I have them winning that game a little closer, but 27-20 win. They improved to 2-1. What's the case for you?
I've got them beating the Detroit Lions, going to 2-1. I think those back-to-back home games, you know, we talked about earlier, but that's something they have to find a way to take advantage of.
Yes. Week four, Carolina Panthers on the road, East Coast game. The Cardinals overcome. 25-20 win. They improved to 3-1. What about you?
Yeah, I've got them winning 30-24. Again, I think they can put up points, and it's going to be about how many points they, or you know, if they can stop other teams.
Week five. So I have them being 3-1 to start off, and I have them going to 4-1 with the blowout win over the Jets on the road, 38-21. They are rewarded. They take advantage of the soft schedule early, but they pick up two East Coast wins, so they improve to 4-1, beating the Jets 38-21.
Yeah, I have them winning that game too, 36-31. I think it'll be a close game, but I think the Cardinals can pull it out in the end.
This is, so we both have them starting 4-1, and that's kind of like that's kind of the key to their season right now. With what they have late in this year, if this Cardinals team is any good, they've got to take advantage early. They can't afford to lose to these potential cupcake teams, because the Jets aren't expected. They were sneaky okay, but do we really believe in Adam Gase's teams? I don't. The Panthers. Yeah, I don't believe in them. I mean, Christian McCaffrey, yes. Teddy Bridgewater, maybe. But that was a bad team a year ago. And the Cardinals definitely need to stop losing to Carolina. That's kind of how I see it. They come home. They hit the road for the Monday night game against the Cowboys. What is your prediction? Did the Cardinals get the upset?
No, I have them falling short in that game on Monday night in a close one, 30-26.
And I have them losing 27-21, so 4-2 heading into their first game against the Seahawks. I have them squeaking by with a 21-20 victory, so they are 5-2 heading into the bye. What is your take on that?
I have them losing that game, so two games in a row, close again. 30-28, lost to the Seahawks.
So you have them 4-3. I've got them 5-2 in the bye. They come off the bye to play the Dolphins at home. I have them blowing them out 34-20. They improve to 6-2. What about you?
Yeah, I have them winning 37-26 in that game.
So my Cardinals are 6-2. Yours are 5-3. The next week against Buffalo at home, I don't have them winning that game. They lose a close one, 23-21. They fall to 6-3.
Yeah, I have them losing that game as well, 25-24.
So 5-4 yours, 6-3 mine. They go on the road to Seattle in on Thursday night. I have them losing that game, even though they like to win in Seattle. They lose that game 30-28, another close one. They fall to 6-4.
Yeah, and I have them winning that game. I think they, for whatever reason, they do well in Seattle, 31-23.
All right, so they after 10 games, we both have them 6-4. They go on the road to New England. I have the Patriots winning that game as of right now, so they fall to 6-5. What about you?
Yeah, I have them losing because I have no idea what to expect of New England and the fact that it's in November in Foxborough.
That could be ugly.
Yeah, I mean, it could be one of those games where they blow them out because New England's just not, you know, good post Tom Brady. I don't think you're ever going to blow out a Bill Belichick team, but, you know, I just don't feel comfortable making a prediction about anything with New England this year right now.
And I didn't want to make any crazy predictions, so I'm saying, oh, New England is a playoff team. They're playing at home. I'm still going to pick that a win for them. So what are they both now? 6-5?
6-5. Yep.
Week 13, I have them picking up a win over the Rams at home, 28-22. They finally beat Sean McVay. They improved to 7-5. What about you?
Yeah, and I've got that flipped. I got a loss 28-24, so they get to 500 on the season.
I've got 7-5. You've got 6-6. They head on the road to the Giants, where I see a barn burner. They win 34-30, so they improve to 8-5 in my case.
Yeah, and I've got them winning that one as well, 28-20.
7-6 in your case, 8-5 in mine. I have them falling to the Eagles at home, 24-20, so they fall to 8-6.
Yeah, and I have them losing to Philadelphia, 28-25. Another close one. I think Philadelphia is going to be a good team, so that's going to be a tough one. But I think, you know, it can go either way. Right now, Philadelphia has that kind of metal that the Cardinals just don't have right now.
So you have them at 7-7. I've got 8-6 heading into week 16 against the 49ers at home. I have them winning that game. They improved to 9-6. What about you?
Yeah, I have them winning as well. I think they're getting close, and a lot of close losses, like to the Rams, to the Eagles, even to the, you know, the Bills. And I think that gets them ready, gets them to 8-7 heading into the kind of the final game of the season and a chance maybe to make the playoffs with that 7 seed now in play.
Do you have them winning in week 17 on the road in LA?
No, I don't. I have them losing both games to the Rams. So they split with the Seahawks and 49ers and then go 0-2 against the Rams. So that really is kind of where the season not falls apart, but, you know, they end up at 8-8. A good enough season. I think anybody would be happy with 8-8 over what we saw last year. Again, another, you know, let's call it 2.5 game improvement in the win column or in the loss column. And I think that would be great, you know, but it all depends on how they lose.
And I also have them losing in the season finale, but they finished the year 9-7. Maybe they're a playoff team, but it's potentially they might miss it with the last season loss, depending on how the Rams are doing that year. And ultimately, the two of our schedules, though, in the way which they differ, is that you have them losing to the Rams both games, and I have them beating the Rams once. Other than that, we're pretty straightforward. You've got an 8-8. I've got a 9-7 team. That's pretty straightforward for me. What do you see as their games as the toughest one on the schedule? I wrote a piece. I think they've got four truly tough games. Three of them are on the road. I think their two Seattle games are their toughest. You've got the San Francisco game in the opener, both Seattle games because they're on short weeks, and then their trip to New England because it's New England. It might not be. It's not. It might not be because of the team at that point, but the environment will be different for except Kyler Murray's not been a snow player. The Cardinals play indoors. I see those as their toughest four games.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not even that concerned with the Dallas Monday night game. The stage might be more than anything, more, you know, a bigger problem than the game, because it'll be kind of the first true prime time. I mean, I know they had the Thursday night game at home on Halloween last year, but everybody gets a Thursday night game. This will be their first true, you know, Monday night. They're the team, you know, this is what everybody's kind of looking forward to. So less the game or less the opponent, and even on the road, more the circumstances. I'm interested to see how they kind of react to that. And then, like I said, that Thursday night Seattle game, you tie that in with that Buffalo game, and that's a really tough two games in 4 days where, you know, you could see this team go from potentially being, you know, 6-2 or 5-3 to 6-5 or 6-4, you know, 5-5. Like, that's just how tough that two games in 4 day stretch is. And then, you know, you pointed out you go to New England the next week. So even though you have that mini bye, like, those are the games that kind of that stand out to me, because the first kind of true prime time affair, and then that 4 day stretch where you got to play Buffalo at home and then travel up to Seattle. I think that's just really going to define who the 2020 Cardinals are.
And then if you had to pick some must wins, like if the Cardinals are going to be competitive, I think there's kind of two keys to that. Number one, they got to split their division of the games. They can't lose. Like, I've always said, I've said this every single year, if the Cardinals are going to be a playoff team, you can't do, you have to win half your division games. However that happens, you have to win three. And then that four-game stretch, honestly, those four games in a row at the beginning, they really need to be 4-1. Those are almost, like, for the success. They might steal a game here or there, so they might be able to afford to lose one of them. But between the Redskins, Lions, Panthers, and Jets, you got to win three of those games and then sneak another win in on a team you're not generally expected to win. So you've got to win the three of those four games if you're going to be a competitive team, because you've got to beat up on the lesser competition.
Yeah, and that's the big thing right now. I mean, I think we are hoping that, you know, Washington, Carolina, New York, and Miami are games, and maybe even the Giants are games where you look at and the Cardinals are the better team. But it's been 5 years, it's been since 2015 that the Cardinals have even been over 500 in an NFL season. So I don't know if it's fair to expect that the Cardinals are a better team until they prove that they're a better team. You get what I'm saying? Like, this isn't even the Ken Wisenhunt Cardinals, where you can look back and go, hey, remember in 2009 and, you know, when they won 10 games and went to the playoffs and beat the Packers first round, you know, that isn't even this team. This is a third coach in 5 years, for an organization that, like I said, they haven't been over 500 since the year 2015. So, you know, we're coming up on 5 years total of this organization not being an over 500 team at any point in the season. And that's that's where it's at right now. You look at it, you and I look at it as, like you said, as fanalists, and we say, no, this team's definitely improved. They're definitely better than the Redskins, the Lions, the Panthers, the Jets, the Dolphins, and the Giants. But the reality is, well, maybe they are on paper, or maybe they are in our mind as fans, but all those teams are thinking the same exact thing we are right now.
Very, very true. Coming up next on the Rise Up C-Rep podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. We'll move on for the schedule. There's a little bit more to talk about as we got some minor roster moves coming up. That's coming up next on Rise Up C-Rep. We're back on the Rise Up C-Rep podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. Couple of things roster-wise. I'm actually a little bit surprised at this point. The Cardinals announced on Tuesday they re-signed cornerback Kevin Peterson, a guy they claimed off waivers. I was surprised because I figured he would have been re-signed earlier, but maybe this was a case where he was testing out the waters and just realized that there was nothing out there. Because he could have been a restricted free agent, they didn't bring it back. Do you see that move? I see it as a good move, just as long as he doesn't necessarily have to play. He's a player I know you liked a lot to have the opportunity, and he did show a few things. But do you see this as... What do you think of the move, basically, of adding Peterson back to the back end of the roster?
I think it's a great depth signing. That's my biggest thing with him, is he's not a guy that's going to hurt you. So I think you have to be okay with it. He's obviously a guy that we did not he showed why he was available. Instead of kind of improving on the small issues that he had, especially with his physicality, he couldn't. And a lot of it is just size. He's an undersized guy. But
very, very thin.
Yeah, and that's what I should have said. He's a very lean guy. But if he's your cornerback five or six, kind of like a depth guy, I think you're comfortable with that. It's if you're needing him to be more, where you're like, oh crap.
I don't mind the move, especially since he has shown a little bit of flash in his career to be able to be a cover guy. Don't ask him to do much against the run, though. He has a few special teams tackles, so he's not afraid to get in there.
And that's the sad thing about it for him is it's, and I hate picking on him, but it's not like he is Patrick Peterson where he avoids contact. It's more that he's just not built for contact. He just doesn't have the frame to hold up, and that's one of the big issues.
Yeah. But as it stands, he's cornerback four or five, depending on whether you put Chris Jones ahead of him or not. They were kind of evenish last year in terms of playing time. So, and considering the fact they did not add a single cornerback in free agency, they didn't draft one. So bringing back Peterson makes sense. Again, they have essentially, in fact, no, it's not just essential, they have brought back the entire secondary from last year, everyone. So Patrick Peterson's back, Robert Alford's back, even though he didn't play. Kevin Peterson's back, Chris Jones is back, Jalen Thompson, Deontay Thompson, Buda Baker, Chris Banjo, and Charles Washington. All of them are back. The only guy who's not back is the guy they cut in Tremaine Brock. So it goes to the notion that in the secondary, they were, but based on what we saw late in the year, they were pleased with their secondary. Notice they made zero additions there. Those actions say a lot.
Yeah, I think so. And it, you know, I think one of the things that we've talked about with this kind of defense in general is just the need of continuity or continuity and you know, playing together, understanding kind of what the defense is needing. We had a lot of issues last year where you saw communication breakdowns more than anything else. And when that's the issue or when that's the concern, then what you do is you try to ease that, especially in this type of offseason where you just need to find a way to kind of not have to teach everything over again to a bunch of guys and then hope that it works out.
There is something – I don't know how closely you guys followed the undrafted. The Cardinals announced 21 undrafted rookie additions, which meant they had to make 3 roster cuts. They only cut 2 guys in Keyshawn Berea and Lyndon Johnson, some defensive lineman, a couple of players you probably have never heard of. Over the course of many days, they only brought 20 in. I did a little bit of digging. I found out which one it was. It was Portland State running back Sergio Hoffman. And it was, you know, like, well, why didn't he end up signing? I reached out to him. Turns out that he is recovering from an injury, and I guess it was a physical thing. And so he and the team agreed to basically pause the contract. After he recovers, I would expect to see an announcement that he has signed his deal, or magically he appears on the roster about the time training camp comes around. So the undrafted rookie Sergio Hoffman is not on the roster. He's recovering from an injury. We could see him later on. That's neither here nor there because he's a Portland State running back. I don't know anything about him other than he didn't actually make it on the Cardinals roster after his name was announced after agreeing to terms.
He's a big – I wrote about him. He's a big kind of short yardage back. He was their short yardage back. That's just kind of who he is.
And the free agents that are out there, I mean, I know very well – that the Cardinals have no money against the cap. They've got about a functional money because they still have to sign their rookies, about $2.8 million in cap space unless they trade Hassan Reddick, unless they do a contract extension, unless they do some restructures. Are there any free agents out there that are worth adding, especially any of the names? Because there are some quality players out there still. Do the Cardinals need to address any of those positions?
That's the hard part. I mean, need is such a strong word. I don't think that they need to do anything desperate, but there is talent that they can add. The problem is that, you know, from a cap space standpoint, they're not in a great position. The one move I would look at right now is recently released Larry Warford, a guy that I've liked since he came out of Kentucky in the draft in 2013, is available, and he was just released because he's really good and makes a lot of money. He's, you know, made the last 3 Pro Bowls, plays right guard. You look at the Cardinals, their right guard's J.R. Sweezy. Definitely not a guy that hurts them, but definitely a guy that can be upgraded. So again, when you talk about need, probably not, but you know, would you be willing to upgrade a younger, better Larry Warford for a J.R. Sweezy? I mean, I think that's a no-brainer. You're talking about a 3-year difference in a guy that's been, again, a 3-time Pro Bowler the last 3 seasons.
But money-wise, that's going to probably be impossible.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing is, yeah, I mean, you save, what, $2 million off Sweezy's deal, but I still don't think you can, you know, figure it out, so to speak. After that, I mean, who do you look at and go, hey, that guy improves the roster? I mean, again, Warford's available, so is Jadeveon Clowney. I mean, just because they're available doesn't mean that they're in the plans or signable. I read that what's the guy's name, the cornerback from Arizona,
Prince Amukamara. But he just
He just signed. Okay. Yeah. And then, so maybe, I mean, maybe a cheap guy like a Mike Daniels, like a defensive lineman late coming in would make sense. Or even like a guy like, and he's super old, but like a guy like Cameron Wake, like real late in the process, like training camp. If there's like an injury
or if they could somehow trade Hassan Reddick.
Yeah, well, good luck with that. Because that's the thing, is our team's really going to trade for Hassan? Because, or are they going to just see, you know, kind of call the Cardinals bluff to see if they'll release him?
I know one guy who I'm sure likes him.
Right?
Matt Rhule, coach at Temple.
Yeah, but I mean, realistically, right now, there's nothing that they need to do. There's plenty that they can do to improve the team. But again, they have to play within the confines of the salary cap. So, you know, like we said, like Larry Warford, I mean, and I'm not even going to talk about Jadeveon Clowney, because, I mean, obviously he would be fantastic addition to the Cardinals. But one, they just signed Devin Kennard for probably more than half of what, or less than half of what he's going to cost. So, you know, you look at Warford, you know, like a Snacks Harrison. Those are guys that, you know, Mike Daniels, those are all guys that would definitely be upgrades or guys that you can plug in as starters and improve. But at what cost? I mean, maybe once you get into July and those guys are going to be willing to take a little less just so they can play, I think then they become more what's the word I'm looking for? Palatable, so to speak.
Coming up next on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the way. We come back and we're going to talk about something that Cliff Kingsbury said is a reason for concern about how they're going to use Isaiah Simmons. That's coming up next on Rise Up C-Red. We're back on the Rise Up C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Isaiah Simmons. If you read into some of the comments that were made, you get the feeling, oh, he's going to be used as a linebacker. Oh, he's going to be used for a lot of different things. Cliff Kingsbury talked about it earlier this week when he had a video conference with media members. And here's the thinking. They were so impressed at his ability to learn all these different positions and perform at a high level that they believe that by having him focus in on one position and yet still playing a number of roles, you know, that his potential, that there's potential to be, like, the sky's the limit, they said. That by making him a linebacker and learning linebacker things, basically, that's it. So he doesn't have to learn the terminology. He doesn't have to learn the safety role. He doesn't have to learn the cornerback's role. He doesn't have to do the edge rusher. It sounds like he's still going to do a number of things, but all within the concept of being a linebacker. Now, Seth, I know one of your major concerns with the addition with drafting Simmons was not about Simmons the player or Simmons the talent. It was about Vance Joseph and the Cardinals and how they would use him. Does this bring any level of concern to you when you hear comments like that?
I mean, it does to the extent of your eighth overall pick's not going to get a ton of reps. I mean, I just don't see where he's going to get on the field consistently over Jordan Hicks and Devondre Campbell. I mean, if you weren't paying nearly, I mean, what is it, $16.5 million to those two players, then I could see it. But, I mean, are you really going to – who are you benching? Now, I'm not saying that he's not going to play, but he's going to play in specific packages and roles to kind of put him in position to be successful. And that was, you know, that was really the concern from the beginning that we had with the pick, is that if he's relegated to the linebacker position, so to speak, where is he going to get on the field consistently? And I just don't see where it's going to be at linebacker where he's going to get on the field in a consistent manner, especially early in the season, over two guys in Hicks and Campbell that are, you know, veterans that are making a lot of money.
Right. It's going to be interesting to how they do the subbing. It sounds like they expect him to play a lot. I actually, the philosophy I sort of agree with, you can have him only learn the linebacker position, but you can still, as you game plan for the week, see George Kittle, if he flexes out to the slot, so you send him out to the slot. You don't have to have him play border cornerback. That just seems unreasonable. You don't need him to play safe. You've got people who already do that. So he's going to be able to do a number of things. He doesn't need to play deep in coverage. They will use some of those other things. I like the concept. So he doesn't have to learn the terminology. He doesn't have to learn the game plan for all the different positions like he did at Clemson. He's going to learn the game plan and the role all within a linebacker context, but still do a number of things. They can still have him line up off the edge. They could still have him blitz inside. They can still have him spy. They could still have him cover the flat on a running back. They could still have him flex out and cover a tight end man-to-man. I think that is probably, especially with the shortened offseason, the smartest way to go. If you want to give him more roles, I don't think it's necessary to have him spend time in the safety room with the defensive backs. It's going to be everything from a context of a linebacker that you then just throw in wrinkles for him specifically. I like that. I think that's a smart way to go. Playing time, it's going to be interesting to see how that goes. Who are they going to sub out? Or are they going to change their sub package to, like, what's that sub package going to look like to include him? Who gets taken off the field? But like I said, I think leading up to the draft, I think that is kind of what will be, it makes him perfect as a rookie, is his versatility. Is you give him specific game plans and you have him learn the linebacker position, but you can use him a number of ways. I actually think that's a big positive.
Yeah, and you want him to have, you know, success early. It's just you want him to get on the field also. But I brought it up, you know, a couple weeks ago after the draft, when we talked about it. If they're bringing him along in a similar role to what they did at Clemson, you know, where they played him, I mean, obviously it was strong safety, but they played him in a specific role in sub packages and then expanded that role his second year. And then his third year, which was this year, is where he kind of took off. It makes sense. And that's probably the way he'll be the most successful. It's just, it goes back to the lack of immediate impact players we've seen in Steve Keim drafts, and it's been kind of a ongoing situation where you can really only point to Kyler Murray, who has been a, you know, immediate impact player, and then only DJ Humphreys has been, you know, a potential long-term impact player guy at this juncture. And that's, you know, depending on how much he gets out of this second contract. So I think that's where the concern comes in more than anything, is that you're wondering, you know, like you said, it's not the idea. It's that, where does he get those snaps and where, you know, how often is he getting those snaps? And that's where you wonder where and how that's going to happen.
Cardinal X on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best heard of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's talk about some of the odds. There's some futures odds out, futures bets available already, months away. And the Cardinals have a few people, coaches and players, who are among some of the favorites for some awards, and some are more long shots than others. So that's time on the next one, Rise of C-Red. We're back on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best heard of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's talk the potential of some awards. Cliff Kingsbury, Kyler Murray, Chandler Jones, Isaiah Simmons, all are among the names of reasonable bets according to the odds. Let's kind of look at some of that. So for Coach of the Year, the favorite right now, according to BetMGM, is Bill Belichick has 10-1 odds. Interesting. For me, the Coach of the Year, it always comes down to expectations versus performance. While I wouldn't necessarily put the Patriots in a position to be great, but with the loss of Tom Brady and a lot of defensive players, if they are decent, that would put Belichick into that conversation. Next, you got Mike Vrabel at 14-1, Mike McCarthy 14-1, and then at 16-1, you've got Kyle Shanahan, Frank Reich, and Cliff Kingsbury. I really, really in terms of a bet, I think Kingsbury is a sneaky good bet. I think if you're looking at of those guys, I think if I had to place a bet, the two I would pick would be Kingsbury and Reich, because of expectations versus performance. I don't know if the Tennessee Titans are going to be able to they'd have to basically perform like they did the second half of the last year for Vrabel to do it. Mike McCarthy, the Cowboys, they'd have to super overperform. I don't know how Shanahan would be able to do it after what he did last year, how he could top that. But Reich and Kingsbury at 16-1 is right there in a sweet spot of teams that could have significant improvement because they've made additions to their team. The Colts with Philip Rivers at quarterback, and the Cardinals with significant additions on defense. And then the addition of DeAndre Hopkins and bringing back players like Kenyon Drake. What do you see Cliff Kingsbury as a realistic possibility as a coach of the year?
I think you kind of hit it on the head. It depends on where they're at the end of the season. If they're in the playoff hunt, I think so. But it also, I mean, you got to look at the teams around the league, and you've got expectations, and then you've got teams that can exceed expectations. And so, you know, if a team like Tampa Bay goes 13-3, you know, Arians is going to get a lot of credit for that. You look at, you know, the Raiders in Las Vegas, if they make the playoffs, John Gruden's going to get a lot of run as coach of the year. So that's kind of where it always falls to, as you kind of astutely pointed out. You're going to – I don't think he's a bad bet. I mean, 100 to get you 1,600 is never a bad deal. But I think with, as we discussed, 9-7 – and a fringe playoff team is not likely to earn Kingsbury Coach of the Year honors. Especially, I think the teams to look out for, you know, Tampa Bay. I think that the Bills and Sean McDermott, because this could be the first team that wins the NFC or the AFC East in what, 12 years.
In forever. Oh my gosh.
And then whatever, you know, whatever the Cowboys do, because it's the Cowboys. I mean, if Mike McCarthy goes 12-4 or 13-3, he's going to get a lot of credit too, where, you know, maybe those teams are all, you know, are all expected to be playoff teams, but, you know, unless you get a team like San Francisco who wasn't really expected to be great, and then they are great. I think that's the only way you can look at a guy like Kingsbury winning it over a over some of maybe the kind of front runners.
Defensive rookie of the year is one that really intrigues me because I'm surprised. Well, and maybe that's just because we understand the Cardinals roster a little bit more. Isaiah Simmons is number two on the list in terms of the shortest odds. You've got Chase Young, understandable sack guy. It would be, you know, it'd be like Nick Bosa again. He's at plus 220, so 2.2 to 1. I don't remember what ratio that comes out to. Next is Isaiah Simmons at 11 to 2, or 5.5 to 1, plus 550. I'm surprised. Like, I guess I get why he's that high because of the potential impact. And if you go back to the player he's compared to, in Derwin James, who was an All-Pro as a rookie, people think that he can have the same impact. But we're sitting here wondering, well, we know he can have an impact, but how is he going to get on the field? That's an interesting set of odds there, in my opinion.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we kind of ran over just now why that's maybe unlikely. Now, if Simmons can get, what would you say, 80% of the snaps, I think he'll have a chance. But I think he's going to have to play 80%+ of the snaps to have that chance, and I'm not sure if he's going to get that much with how they're speaking right now about him being used.
Unless he, in a limited, he has big, though, if he manages in 50% of the snaps to have 50 tackles, 60 tackles, 5 sacks and 3 interceptions.
That would be
something. Or if you saw, because Chase Young, he's going to be the favorite, and he's really the one I would bet on, because if there's one sexy stat for a defensive player, it's sacks. And Chase Young is by far the best pass rusher this group. He's at least as good as Nick Bosa, is what it kind of looks like. And Nick Bosa was a runaway with that award last year.
Right, and that's where I think it's going to be a problem, is because Bosa's going to... or it's not Bosa. Young's going to get more snaps, and he's quite frankly in a better situation in terms of getting the opportunity to put up those snaps.
If we look at Kyler Murray, he has 25-1 odds for both MVP and Offensive Player of the Year. If you want to look at trends, he would be the trendy pick because of the last 2 years. Patrick Mahomes, MVP in his second year. Lamar Jackson in his second year. Kyler Murray now entering his second year. But he, in terms of MVP, he falls behind Patrick Mahomes, Russell Wilson, Lamar Jackson, Tom Brady, Drew Brees, Dak Prescott, and then is equal to Deshaun Watson, Aaron Rodgers, Carson Wentz, and yes, those three. I don't know what to think. I think the thing with Kyler Murray is, if we look at the quarterbacks who have won MVP, because they've won the last several MVPs, one, they have to be a really good team, or a surprisingly good team, and they have to lead the league in some major statistical passing categories, so touchdown passes, passing yards, passer rating. I think Kyler's going to have a great year. Is he going to be MVP worthy? Especially, I mean, unless the Cardinals are a 11 to 13 win team, and Kyler Murray is throwing for over 4,000 yards and rushing for almost 1,000. Okay, I get that, but that's a tough group to try and crack if your team's going to be above average, don't you think?
Yeah, if they're where we have them, which I think is respectable, he doesn't have a chance. If they are competing for the NFC West, and the NFC West doesn't have a surprising down season, which I don't think anybody thinks is going to happen, but, you know, let's just say, you know, that would be the one way they compete, and he's not in the MVP talk. But if they're in contention to win the NFC West, then he will be in contention for the MVP. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. And now, offensive player of the year is a different animal, because that
you factor in running backs.
Right. And you've got players ahead of him. You've got Patrick Mahomes as the favorite. Lamar Jackson makes sense. Christian McCaffrey, who I did not realize this, but when I looked at his stats, I didn't realize he did 100, he did 1,000, 1,000. What David Johnson was planning on doing, Christian McCaffrey did it. Saquon Barkley, Russell Wilson, Michael Thomas, last year's Offensive Player of the Year, Derrick Henry, and then Kyler Murray is tied at 25-1 with Ezekiel Elliott, Deshaun Watson, and Dalvin Cook. I think that's probably a less likely, unless he unleashes also the running game.
I would guess it would have to be something in the realm of 5,000 total yards and yes, 50 total touchdowns for Kyler to be in the conversation for either, unless the Cardinals are 13-3 and there are a bunch of wins where he's not having to do a lot. Where there's a bunch of wins where he's not having to put up huge stats, or, you know, kind of the Lamar Jackson situation last year, where there were games where he, you know, in the third quarter or in the fourth quarter, it was Robert Griffin the third time. That's, you know, maybe he wins the MVP still that way, but I think that offensive player of the year type thing is, you're talking, I think 5,050 is kind of the benchmark that you would set and expect him to hit if he's going to be a true player for that award.
And then lastly, Chandler Jones. It looks like his line has moved. I believe he was 30-1 not too long ago. He's up to 20-1, so that's much more respectable. Behind Aaron Donald, Khalil Mack, J.J. Watt, Nick Bosa, Stephon Gilmore, T.J. Watt, Von Miller, and Derwin James. Well, same as Derwin James. The last I looked, and I believe this was not too long ago, he was at 30-1. He was even behind Billy Wagner, Danielle Hunter, Joey Bosa, and Myles Garrett. I'm not sure what to think about him, because, you know, last year it was one sack away. It really was. He gets one more sack, he's at 20. I think he's a landslide winner for Defensive Player of the Year. He misses out on one sack in the season finale. He doesn't even win the sack title. But I thought he should have gotten it in 2017. I understand why he didn't get it last year. He should have been more in the mix. But they're off the edge. It's going to be hard for him, especially since he still doesn't have the reputation of being great at the run, too. He had a great year in 2017 against the run as well, but he's still playing on he's got to be on a better defense. And otherwise, I like him. I like the potential for the award, but the defense has got to be better if he's going to be really in the mix.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the overall takeaway from all of this, is that the odds are probably at the right spot for all these guys, because there are too many this team needs, you know, one more win, one more this or that or the other, to feel like they're, you know, going to be serious contenders at this juncture. So I would say, you know, like we said, you're not against it, but it's not in any way where you're like, yeah, I definitely would go put, I mean, if you're going to put money on anything, I think the Murray at 25-1, because he has the best potential to make that happen. I still don't think he's going to win it, but he would have the best potential to win it. So I think that would be your smartest play. You know, if you want to go throw $20 down and win 500, or throw $100,
whatever it is, that's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And with that, we will end this edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, episode 267. We'll be out for at least 2 weeks unless something major happens. There's not really much going on in terms of the Cardinals right now, or not much to know. We're not seeing any practices. It's just, we'll just leave it at that. We'll be back in at least a couple of weeks to talk more off-season stuff. On behalf of the show, I'm Jess Root. That's Seth Cox. Thanks for listening. As always, we will be back again soon. Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Sea Red podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red. Whoa!